So, Mara Abdin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're not exactly sure of when this episode is going to air, but just to give a little context to the listeners, we're recording this episode during the crazy DeepSeek frenzy week, which is actually super lucky for us here today because this last week brought the most attention I've ever seen actually to open source LLMs, which is what we're going to talk about here today, right? So we recently had a great conversation with your colleague Gustavo De Rosa about the development of 5.4. And since we tried to give an overview of the entire process, it was a fantastic conversation, by the way. Links will be in the description. We had a bit of a limited time to discuss the aspects of that fascinate me and Fabricio as well, which is the use of synthetic data and how it played such a huge part in the development of 5.4. This is exactly your area of expertise. I just can't wait to pick your brains about this. But I'd like to kick things off by asking you about this newfound interest of humanity, it seems, into open source models from this last week. You don't have to make specific comments, of course, about your competitors, but given your experience in LLM research and training, did this last week sort of unlock this new scenario in the open versus closed strategies for LLM development? Or was this sort of like just a blip that tends to happen from time to time, only the entire world decided to watch this time around?
You know, open source versus closed source, there's a, you know, pros and cons to this. I've actually, you know, I mean, I take my input is a little bit biased because I am working in the open source space. And so for with the Phi models, we've pushed heavily into open source. There's the reason we've done so, and the reason I still also believe in the Phi project and other projects I've worked on, is because there is a level of performance that you have to reach before you close source. And before that, there is the downside of close sourcing is it's just not worth it. Where basically, when you put things out and you make them available to devs and to students and to researchers and to honestly just people who are curious, whether it's commercially or academically or whatnot, you basically, you give it out not just as a final artifact, but as a start to end research tool. So you're teaching people something. You're giving them something that isn't just, okay, this is just, I only want you to use it. So people can build on it, people can learn from it. And also there is just the advantage of including people in your research. That is always a nice thing to be like, this is, you are part of this process. When the reason that closed source is also not a bad idea is because, I mean, some things are too delicate or to have too many variables that you do need to close source them in order to have some control of quality. And so that is something that you reach very far into any research area. And in the LLM area, I will say that there's still so many things that we don't know and we haven't really figured out fully and we haven't excelled at. And there's just so much still to learn. And the more brains you have working on this and the more eyes you have on this, the better. And so there's in 5 years or so, there will be open source, but there will be no need to it. But at the moment, it is quite useful.
Do you see this as something that these models, like for example, DeepSeek and other models, regardless where they come from, whether you come from China, from the US, from Europe or whatever, they're going to be in the market. They're going to be out there. Like on Hugging Face, anyone can download them. Do you see them being used by companies instead of the private models, mostly in the next year or 2-3 years?
Yeah, I think I see them as a starting point for companies to, one, to be encouraged to build their own models and to actually learn something on how to build their own models or a base model for their own use. However, there is a huge advantage in building your own model for your use case. It's obviously that's not something available for anyone. There it requires a certain number of resources, but open source and smaller models are, you know, when we first, maybe like this is, we're talking like this has been a long time, but this has been like a few years of this. So if you look back maybe a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, the idea of LLMs is just, it was not as accessible to train and to run and to just like the inference was even a huge bottleneck. And so the good thing is the more you open source this research and the more you put it out there, the people like become better at it. And so one of these things is the reduced skepticism towards SLMs. And so whether it's DeepSeek, whether it's other types of model, whether it's a reasoning, you know, long chain of thought, kind of model, or it's something that's a bit more general use like 5.4, it still basically makes it more accessible. And so there is a huge advantage in just your accessibility to the data, to the training process, to knowing what you put in there, to knowing what you didn't put in there. And so hopefully there will be a world where people are just have more, not just accessibility to the models, but to the artifacts that got them there, and that it's there are, if we have ways of doing this efficiently in a way that, you know, that is not incredibly expensive.
Right. And just my last question about the fallout of this last week, so we can jump into the 5.4 model and the whole synthetic data thing. One of your specialties, your general area of specialties, LLM pre-training. So just give this a shot. Let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. One aspect that has been very discussed this last week was DeepSeek's decision to just sort of skip the supervised fine-tuning and just stick to reinforcement learning, right?
Yeah.
The consensus seems to be that they did this because of the whole embargo, US restraints. But on a more practical level, this has been regarded as a pretty neat trick, right? That they pulled to make the best out of the situation and turn out to be very worthwhile. Without, of course, giving anything away about future Phi versions or projects, do you expect this trick to become a more widely used pipeline to train LLMs, or was it just a one-off because of the circumstances?
Yeah, honestly, it's a good question. It's a good research question. It's something that we have been thinking about, and that, you know, just it's very obvious. It's just like, okay, will this actually generalize? And you can test this out if you're curious by simply just taking another model that is, you know, that this has not been created for the sake of this, or it's not been SFT'd, it doesn't have the kind of data that is long chain of thought data, and then try to replicate what they did. I mean, they were open source, so that's actually a totally valid experiment, and then see if it works. My intuition, if you were to ask me, is that it's completely dependent on the base model. So the base model, one, their base model is not too small. It's actually, it's a, you know, respectable size. And so that's one. And two is what you're doing here at the RL stage is not really teaching the model to reason. What you're doing is you're exposing its own abilities. So you're saying in the RL stage, you're saying you already know this. You know how to reason this. I just want you to invoke these different modalities of reasoning, like backtracking and planning and correcting yourself or questioning yourself. I want you, like, you're just reinforcing style and these modalities, these reasoning modalities. But the actual domain knowledge and the reasoning abilities are from the base. And so the reason the SFT stage comes in between those two usually is because if your base does not have even the vocabulary to do this, to basically, like, it doesn't know how to say, wait, let me backtrack. Wait, this doesn't look right. Maybe I should verify this. If it doesn't even, if there is nothing in your pre-training data that has this kind of behavior, then there's no way in our, like, what are you exposing? What are you reinforcing? You're not training, you're reinforcing. What are you reinforcing if it doesn't even exist? And so if you don't, if you can do an SFT stage in between with a base model like this, then that would be amazing. What is the data that goes into SFT? It's, I mean, the, you know, their speculation is that you can just distill from a model that can already do this, that can generate this long chain of thought data, like the R1 models, or the more principal thing, and this is probably a lot more of an interesting research question, is can you generate it synthetically? I think you can. It's not easy. It's kind of expensive, but you don't need that much because it's SFT. And it's, you know, it's done in what I would say is almost always just the go-to, which is complex multi-call, multi-agent pipelines for synthetic data.
And I mean, you are within Microsoft, like within this whole bubble that includes also OpenAI. So you have access to their models. And wouldn't it be, or isn't it a way to create such a model as well, like a 5.5 or something like that, just using basically GPT-4o or even OpenAI-01 as this strong base model, like you mentioned?
That's actually a huge misconception. We do not get to use OpenAI models. It's just, it's not about like the technical folks. It's just not part of the Microsoft OpenAI deal. People think that we can just train on their models. Not true. We're two separate research kind of streams. We have certain areas where we partner, but training is the least of them, actually.
I see. But do you have then an idea to create such a model that you could then use to create a 5.5, like a distilled version, maybe?
Yeah, to create a model that, you know, you mean that does long chain of thought?
Or no, or just like a super strong model that can be used to then create an SLM.
Yeah, so there is This effort does exist at Microsoft. It's under, actually, Mustafa Sleiman's new org. I don't know if you know about this. For the Phi team, we were working with them for about 6 months. And then we switched to Phi4. And anyway, but basically, well, we're all under the same company. So their group heads in that direction. And, you know, it's not a surprise, but they work in model training and larger scale.
All right, we got rid of the preamble. Enough of that. Let's talk about synthetic data. Your exact area of specialty within LLM pre-training is high-reasoning, multi-step synthetic data. So, quoting George Costanza's father on Seinfeld, what the hell does that mean?
I'm a huge Seinfeld fan, honestly. Let's see. So what that means is there are things that you can do synthetically that are really simple, but in order for synthetic data to be integral and to replace a lot of your organic data, or to extract the most out of organic data, you need to put a little bit of work into it. And it's honestly a lot of fun. So personally, I've been on the Phi group since a little bit after Phi 1 days. And so it was at the time, we were a small group, so we did a lot of this learning collectively, and it was great to be part of that. But what we learned over time is that you can start with simple things, right? So you can do rewriting, augmenting existing data, you filter large scale organic data, maybe you create some multiple choice questions and so on. Or textbooks all you need, right? So textbook style data that you basically is what it usually created is just, you know, one or two prompts in out. And that's about it, right? So that is fine. That's perfectly fine. That is not a way, however, to reduce some of the dependency on organic data when it comes to high reasoning or complex kind of inputs or complex training data. And so the way to really get there is through extracting as much as possible from an LLM. And the only way to go beyond distillation is to do not a synthetic generation, more of a pipeline generation, right? What I mean by that is, let's say I have a really complex task of I want to create student-tutor chats, right? I have two things here I really need to do, which is one, I need to make sure that the tutor is a good tutor, which means, you know, they don't give the answer away, they're patient, they ask questions, they correct the student when they're wrong, they can be derailed and come back to the conversation. That's a lot, asking a lot. And two, it needs to be good at the domain it's teaching. Let's say it's math, like middle school math. This is a lot for one prompt to do. This is a lot. This is also hard data to come by. The nice thing about synthetic data is that it's very wide domain. So you can do just about anything, right? I want to create whatever. I want to create fan fiction stories. I want to create, I don't know, medical interactions. It's like you can come up with an idea and you can implement it, even if it doesn't exist. So back to the example, tutor-student chats. So how can I actually do this? I can't do this in one go. It's just pretty much impossible. So you will get incredible high error rates. You will get low entropy. It will not be diverse. It will be very monotone. So what you do is that you break this complex task into smaller tasks, and you extract. You get a model that is, let's say, like GPT or Claude or Llama 70B, and this is a model that is relatively capable. And you say, okay, instead of generating this once, I have an agent that generates the tutor. I have an agent that generates the student. I have a verifier in between. I have an advisor agent. I have an agent that creates a student profile where, you know, for example, a student can have, let's say, like their English is not their first language, or maybe they have problems at home or home is very loud. And so, which means sometimes the chat might be interrupted or the student might need this tutor to repeat things a few times, things so on. You just inject basically this inject entropy through breaking down this complex task, and instead of letting the model converge into the same space repeatedly. Maybe you even have, you know, you can, like, what kind of behavior is a student doing? Are they asking a question? Are they asking a dependent question? Are they, you know, being interrupted? Are they getting stuck? Are they making a mistake? And so on, so on. So you end up with, you know, 10 prompts, 20 prompts per generation, and then you write out this pipeline where you as the human are telling you do this, and I'm going to tell you all how to interact, and there you go. What you end up with is genuinely high-quality synthetic data with low error rate that is entropic. It's really fun, honestly, and this generalizes. I do this on a daily basis. This is my daily job, and I love it. So that's what it means to have multi-call. Long description, but it's very nuanced, so it's hard to describe sometimes.
But it sounds like a very hands-on process, basically. You have to be like manually creating these things all the time.
It is very hands-on. And there is a question of how can you automate this? Unclear if we need to automate this. You can automate parts of it. We might want to automate parts of this. Unclear why we would want to. It's not that we do this on a gigantic scale. So far, I don't think there is a very clear path to how to automate. This is another interesting question that at least I've been asked, I've thought about. Is it, because it is, I mean, I spend a lot of my time really just looking at prompts, looking at outputs, optimizing my pipeline, reading examples. I read a lot of these samples that come out and I keep tuning and tuning until I'm happy. You know, I try to create synthetic evals that go along with my generations. You know, it's a lot of work, but at the end, once you're happy with what you have, you can generate pre-training scale, like 10 billion tokens and so on, like 5, 10, whatever. It depends on how nuanced the task is, of course. And it's, it does scale, which is nice. So far, I guess the manual work is worth it. So not complaining.
And you touched on a topic that is very interesting, which is like, how do you know that you got to a place that you're happy with your results? Like you said that you created these evals. How do you create them? Like, and how do you decide on the metrics?
Honestly, I do think for evals, it's a bit of a, I mean, like, I feel much stronger that the need for humans in the loop, or human evals, or human written evals, even more than human written data, just because you need a human somewhere in the loop. And so when I say synthetic evals, that is something that would come after you ablate or after you train a model. However, when you work with synthetic data, really your first priority needs to make sure, like, a lot of your manual and your reading and your eyeball and your tuning and your iterations need to happen before you generate anything beyond just, you know, more, less than 1,000 samples, right? You don't want to waste your resources. You don't want to waste your time. You don't want to ablate for no reason. You have to do the majority of the work beforehand. And so you put a lot of work in there, and then you generate your data. Once you're happy, you're like, okay, I think this is going to give me something good. Let's say it's something very nuanced or very odd. Like, I mean, for example, you know, like, let's say I have like the same example I gave, like student tutor, right? So I mean, can you probably find something that can evaluate this specific skill? Maybe what you can also do is part of your generation to think of evals in parallel. And so let's say I set aside a certain number of chats that I had created, and then I can, maybe something about this student tour chat that I have a problem with is that it's hard for the model to figure out when the student actually made a mistake or didn't make a mistake. Right, so, which is a true story, by the way. So how do you, because you just get a lot of false negatives or false positives, and it is genuinely difficult. And so what at least something you could do here is, like, maybe you put aside part of your synthetic chats as a test set, 100 of them or so, and then you cut them off at a place where you know the student made a mistake, or you know the student make a mistake, because you generated this data. It's not, you did it one line by line, right? So it's fake. You know exactly what you did. And so you have a ground truth, because that's where it came from. And so at that point, you pair this chat with this ground truth and maybe some LLM rubric for an LLM judge, and you create these evals that will not be, they're just tests for something very nuanced, right? So they're probably not represented and not sufficient to test out your LLM. But for this skill, at least now, if I train on, you know, maybe I'm doing an ablation on 3 billion tokens of this type of data, I want to see, did I do something? Is there an improvement from the base model on this synthetic eval that I created? You know, did my work from the very beginning pay off? And so, and you get some extra signal that it's that's the thing about synthetic data. It's usually so specific for a specific thing and task. And this is a good thing about it, that it often doesn't pair with evals. And you really shouldn't limit yourself with academic benchmarks or things that are already existing. Like, that is just a bad idea. Working towards a benchmark is just unprincipled and just like insufficient in every way.
And you already touched a little bit on this, and this is almost a rhetorical question, but I think it's important to establish a baseline. Why is synthetic data becoming so important to train new models?
You know, it's the same idea, is that it is so flexible. There are so many things you can do. So many domains are just not covered, and certain skills are just not covered. And that's one But the other thing is that it's you have a lot of control. And so taking organic data in large, large amounts, even trying to filter it synthetically or not, right? It's a difficult task, and you will have a very high, like you will obviously still have very noisy data, often low quality. Rewriting it is also, I mean, that's the low, I would say that's ground zero of synthetic data is just rewrites. But you can train SLMs or you can train smaller models with really high quality training data, right? That's really the only way to do it, is that you have to put in all your work into making sure your data is squeaky clean. You know, and diverse, and high reasoning, and low error, and so on, so on. And the only really reliable way to do this is to have full control of how it was created, right? You still do need, by the way, I think at the stage that we are, and you still need some organic data because synthetic data has its cons. It depends on what you're generating. You can offer, like, it's hard to cover everything, even though you do have control over what domains you want, like even nuanced domains and so on, but it's hard to cover everything that is not organically covered in real data and in books and in internet data and so on, and GitHub repos and whatnot. And two, it's still, you get diverse tones from real data, unlike synthetic data, which is don't like to say that it sounds robotic. It does not sound robotic anymore. There are ways to make it not sound robotic. I would say that LLMs generating this data have actually gotten a lot better at not being very robotic sounding, but it's still more monotone than you would like it to be. And it doesn't create this robustness that you want your LLM to be trained on.
And how do you create the synthetic data about specific topics that you don't really master? Like sometimes you don't know what you don't know, like the Dunning-Kruger thing. You don't know even what is the right answer to ask about it. So how do you go about that?
You mean I don't know personally, or I don't know
or
that we
the
need
person
this?
Who's the person who's creating the synthetic data. Like
the royal you.
Yeah, the okay. Royal you. Yeah, exactly.
That's a good question, because especially, okay, so there's different types of synthetic data. Some of it is very specific that it's, you know, I have 100 domains that I want to cover, that like 100 skills that I want to cover. Does that cover everything? Almost no. Actually, no, it will not cover everything. So back to the earlier question, which is it like, why is synthetic data so important? Is it enough? And this is part of the reason why you still need organic data is, and even if you don't use organic data is, you still need to seed with organic data, and seeds is a whole other topic, by the way. Like seeds are the backbone of synthetic data. And so you need to, sometimes your seeds and your synthetic data shouldn't be very, I would say, bubbled up. So it needs to be a bit wide domained. It needs to be open-ended, where you take Reddit posts, for example, it could be just about anything, and then you augment them or you rewrite them or you, you know, obviously legally if you can, just to say, you know, and then just an example of something that is, could cover a lot of the things that you don't know that you don't know, right? And that's it's kind of a tricky balance, you know. Not everything has to be, by the way, like, not everything has to be math and science and, you know, high PhD level reasoning. Some things can just be everyday talk, and, you know, you need to, especially for general purpose models, you need to cover for everybody. Some people are interested in, you know, the science of cereal. I don't know. you have to be inclusive of all these subtopics. I don't know what else to call them. So I guess that's the one way to mitigate it.
And since you mentioned Reddit, I have to ask, how do you go about controversial topics? Like, you have to put in the data. Do you have to create such data that is controversial or not? Like, I don't know, someone asks, what happened on January 6th or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. In my personal opinion, I think that inevitably, just like the internet, you can't really control some technologies, right? And the only way is that you have to basically get society to adapt to how to use these technologies, right? To how to, like, at some point, I'm sure when the internet came out, people freaked out that this is like gonna, you know, oh my God, it's like so many bad contents. And it's just, you know, it's like, how do we let anyone use it? How do we let kids use it? You know, which is still very valid questions. However, we as a society adapted without limiting what is, you know, an amazing product, an amazing thing, an amazing tool that we have, right? And so personally, I think we will converge to a similar place with AI, where you can't, it's inevitable that there will be many, many use cases of AI and many, especially as it grows and more people use it, it's just not as easy to control, but we have to learn how to use it. On the other hand, at this stage that we are in, we're not at this stage. We're still at the stage where people like me who work on models like Phi in companies like Microsoft, we do care to just, we like to slow that down. And so we do this by filtering all of our data. We take out a lot of topics that are like harmful content or anything that's like racist or sexist or just, it's like fairness filtering basically, right? So we're still at a stage where our models are still, we're still learning what we're even doing. We're still trying to perfect our recipes. We're still trying to put something out there into the research world that is that people will use and will learn from and will teach us from. And so it's still not in a place where it's not as mature, it's not mature enough to get there. And so the way we do to slow this down is by basically we want the focus to be on the science at the moment. Until we get there and we mature there, then eventually the world will converge into a place, just like the internet, will converge to a place with AI where it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't actually matter. We've done our part, right? Now we're just using it and we're just consuming this product.
Are these constraints mostly done in pre-training or post-training?
Both. In pre-training, we filter our data before it even is seen by the model. And in post-training, also, you always have to do, if you're putting something out there, you still always have to do safety post-training, which is like, even before we release, we just have all these benchmarks that we have to pass on, honestly, before, like, as a group and also as Microsoft as a company, anyone who puts anything out there, they have to pass a lot of checks so we're not putting out harmful content.
There's one issue that when LLM started to become this huge thing that they are, that folks used to say is that in a general way, people used to say, oh, the internet's going to get filled with crap created by LLMs. The crap will be used to train newer models and it's going to happen this whole anxietification thing that Cory Doctorow says. And in this last year, I think that we've seen studies and then flash forward to actual 5.4 that prove that that's not the case if you have the data created in the proper way. But you, I imagine, went through sort of this process during the development of 5.4. So what was your takeaway? What did you learn about the process of creating synthetic data that you took away from training 5.4 and that you go, well, I've come this far and this is very interesting that you think about?
Yeah, the reason I would say to these people, it's unlikely this will happen anytime soon, that the internet will be filled with crap from LLMs and that those will actually train new models, because LLMs can do that. It's just not, this is why I have a very intense job, because I have to put in a lot of work into actually creating synthetic data that can train models, that is valuable, that isn't actually crap. And you train on crap data, you will get a crap model. No one's going to use it. No one cares. No one's going to put in the effort to actually use it. The reason people would use model like 5.4 or the LLM models or so on is because someone actually did a lot of work into making sure it's a usable product, making sure it's you can use it for something, it's good for you. Whether it's it has actual capabilities and good performance. And so it's not easy at the moment. It's like at the moment we still don't know how to automate it in a way that it, in a quality level that is comparable to a human who knows what they're doing at least. It's just not in the, at some point maybe we will figure this out and then the internet will be, you know, full of, let's just not, at that point maybe it's just not crap and then it will train. The thing is, you can't train on crappy data. You need good data, right? So, and maybe by that point, we will actually have figured out the more important bits, which is how do we do this correctly? And if we get to a place where we can automate synthetic generations and we can good enough to train new models, like we should all be very happy. That's pretty, it's nice to see that in our lifetimes. That's a really difficult thing to achieve, you know, and it's not unclear if it's a bad outcome. It will be an uncontrolled outcome. However, that's likely what will happen. You know, the next generation will just have to adapt to this. But I mean, at this moment, the thing is that it's still not as accessible. And most people who have access or resources to do this really feel the responsibility to use them, you know, efficiently, to actually put in the work in using these resources. And that's good for the research.
After releasing 5.4, what uses have you seen that were sort of unexpected already, either from the community or actual real world cases that someone that is not from the community started using it and has been just presented a project that is fun, is cool, and that has caught your attention?
That's a good question. Honestly, I'm not as good as keeping up with our use cases, just because I'm like, okay, this is really sad, but we put out models and we were like, okay, we have to go to work the next day and do more things. Right. Instead of like being like, oh my God, let's all sit around and celebrate our new, you know, accomplishment. It's sadly, we're like, okay, people are pressured now. We have to do other things. But I, you know, I'm amazed by how people have fun with our models and how, and I have been like, I've gotten a lot of good feedback from more than just devs and researchers, because it's an open source model, from commercial startups, like startups that, for example, do things like create synthetic data, for example. Like they're trying to do this thing we're talking about, automate something. That's actually something I was told recently, and I thought, oh, that's actually pretty cool, because you don't have access to train your own models, and Phi is, it's a small model. It's probably not that expensive to run for you. It's also has a lot, like it has, the thing is about synthetic data is that it's, if it comes from an LLM, it's easier to learn by an LLM. And so this is two levels down, right? So Phi is heavy on synthetic. So it learned from it, its token distribution is synthetic. And so it will create good synthetic data. And I just thought that was a really cool use case. And that people are commercially even being unblocked by Phi, which is, you know, it was a big question mark for, especially we are from a company. It's not like we're MSR, so we're still a research lab, but it's the question is, are we giving away advantage? And I, by open sourcing fully, and I go back to the same thing, which is we're not at a place where we actually get good feedback when people use this, even commercially, use our products. And so what do you know? Go ahead, generate synthetically with 5.4.
Right. Just as a quick comment, it must be very weird to, for you, 5.4 is old news, right? You don't have to comment on it, but you're probably working on 5.5, 5.6. I don't know. So by the time it reaches the world, you go like, well, oh yeah, we did that. That's cool. Yeah. And you can't read the comments on it because you're working on the next version. So it must be a weird situation to see the world find out about something you've been working so hard for so long, up to the point that it's not really news anymore when it gets out.
Yeah. There. You know, it's, you'd be surprised by the inner politics of research labs, where we don't even know exactly when and what we're releasing. Right. We work towards a model. What is that model? Question mark. We know we have a holistic view of what we want this model to be able to do. We know it needs to be better than what we've already built. And we're proud of all our models, right? We're proud of all the things we put out there. If we're not, we don't bother to put them. And so it's I will say yes, though, the excitement is usually before we put out the model, actually. That's really the height of it. And as soon as it's out, it's there for a few days, and then we're like back to work.
Right.
The good feedback and you know, and getting to talk about it and having conversations like this one, it does propagate well into new projects, and it just gets us more motivated to keep doing what we're doing.
Mara, one thing that we've seen on the benchmarks was that 5.4 was amazing, like really, really amazing, better than GPT-4o, which is a much bigger model in math, in science, in MMLO as well. But it did quite poorly in factual knowledge. And this was, according to Gustavo, that we interviewed as well, the link was going to be here in the description, mostly because of this thing, the difference that you train the model mostly with synthetic data. So do you see a way around this in the future or in the near future to get better numbers at this factual knowledge benchmark still using this synthetic data?
Yeah, I do. There are two probably paths here. One is, I would say, if you still want to stick with synthetic data, better seeding with more knowledge, which is something that I guess was It's mitigatable. We can change this. This is just something that wasn't the focus of 5.4, but could we have done this? If we could have probably done this. It just wasn't we wanted the model to be really good in reasoning. Keep in mind that it isn't SLM. So what is the value of an SLM? We want it to be really good at reasoning, right? So that's one way, is that you seed with more knowledge heavy, more diverse organic data that has this natural distribution of knowledge in all these topics that 5.4 is missing, right? What do I mean by seed? You could, that could mean just about anything. You can use it to augment it, to rewrite it, to use it to create other synthetic seeds, and then from those seeds generate data, and so on and so on. You can use it to create taxonomies of domains that you want to talk, like you can have a domain, like a taxonomy, a tree of domains you want to cover, and you can get as nuanced as you'd like, and so on and so on. That's one way, is to just put in more work and focus on it, which is very obvious. I still think that if we redo, if we train 5.4 same way and then we add this type of data, we'll probably improve quite a bit. The other thing, which if you don't want to do this, and the thing is, keep in mind with SLMs, you don't want to train on, there is kind of a balance you have to do between your raising your knowledge, right? So because it's small scale, you don't want a giant token space of knowledge data and to overpower the knowledge, to overpower the reasoning tokens. And so if you have to make the choice and you're like, okay, I actually want the model to, I care a lot more about reasoning. And so I will make sure the majority of my data is reasoning heavy and just, a percentage of it is knowledge heavy. And you have to make that choice. What is a compromise here? And so one thing is that we can synthetically add data that it allows the model to use tools like NRAG, and that can perform things like deep research, and it can, I think deep research tools are very interesting, where a model has the ability not only to just prompt a search engine, which is a weird skill, by the way, that you would not think you as a human being have, we have learned how to Google things. That's not obvious. Why would a model know how to Google things? From where? That's data does not exist. But you can synthetically generate this kind of data because you know what it looks like, and you can teach the model how to do it. You can even, and it's not just a one go kind of thing. If you really want to search the internet deeply, you would do it in an iterative fashion, right? So you get them, the model can go in there and it can retrieve the information, and then it can refine its search, and it can maybe search for new things, and it's really doing deep research on the internet. And so that's like a function calling or a tool use that you can add in there just to kind of close a little bit of the gap, of the knowledge gap. And I will say that is kind of where we were like at the end of the day when we put out 5.4, we're like, okay, but our model can use the internet, so maybe let's just go the reasoning route, have you on the reasoning route. We actually internally, for fun, on our internal playground, put out a version of Phi that can use in a UI that can use search engine. It was just to play with, and it's actually pretty decent.
And speaking about general models, let's say some hypothetical future models that you're creating, 5.5, 5.6, or even something else, Microsoft P. When you decide that you're going to create a new model like that, do you start kind of from scratch? Do you cold start it with the weights that you had from 5.4, for example? How do you go about that?
If it's a new general case model, then probably from scratch. Yeah, it's like you will always be able to tell from the name, really. So if the name is something new, if a base is 5.4, we're honest about this, so we'll still say 5.4-something or 5.4.5 or so on, where it's the same, maybe we are happy with the base and want to do something new with the post-training, then we'll do something with the post-training, but it'll still be 5.4 or something, right? However, if you want a whole new general purpose model, then it'll probably be trained from scratch. Will we reuse a lot of our old data? Yeah, likely. I will say there is a lot of data in common between our older models. However, we do try, just as a group, we've evolved into what do we think is good data? What do we think is good synthetic data? How can we actually generate better data? And so on and so on. And it's just, if we come up with something better and we have the ability to do it and we have the time to do it, then we go for it. And often we will take an old skill or old domain or an old data set and revive it in a way that is more nuanced.
I think my last question for you is, For folks listening here and that are interested in getting into LLM pre-training, what are the skills that you would tell them to develop? What are the language, the stacks that you deal with in your everyday work life?
Yeah, interesting question. Definitely Python. I mean, I actually didn't use Python that much in my career until LLM land. And so a lot of it was like Java or C and C++ and C Sharp, which is very popular in Microsoft. I think, it's because it's a Microsoft product probably. But Python for sure. The LLM space is very Python friendly, almost exclusively in many cases. A lot of people I work with don't know how to code anything but Python, actually. And especially people from like non-traditional ML backgrounds, like, you know, math or theory or economics and so on. And so Python, as well as just getting comfortable with LLMs as in your daily life. I mean, you should use, there's no reason not to use some Copilot in your daily coding. These tools are here. The world's creating them for you. You should use them, and you should learn from how do you actually talk to a model. Knowing how to communicate with a model is a big part of my job. It says, like, how do you actually, I would know what a model can and can't do. And so just integrating them into it, pretty much everything I do. It's just, there's no point not to do it. There's no point resisting it. It's inefficient. And so I would say Python, and just kind of get maybe some open source training infrastructures is also a good idea. If you want to do training, there's a lot of, GitHub is great, and you know, and the open source world is great, and there's a lot of toy models you can fine tune and train just to get familiar with how to do them. Obviously, try to keep up with the research. I know it's incredibly intense, and archive is scary, but it's these days at least. But there are things that are just they get to the spotlight because often they're good, and so just try to keep up with what people are doing, and get to the technical bit of the papers, not just the exciting, this is new and this is out there.
And if you're talking about Microsoft, like people who want to join your team there, should they go more like what, TensorFlow, PyTorch, Jax,
sure,
or what?
All the above.
Yes.
But all the above. But honestly, it depends on also what they want to do. There are things that, there are many skill sets and many kind of areas in training, right? So if you work on things like data or training or fine tuning or evals, you know, try not to, like, there's room for everybody. And so pick something that you really like to do and like play with all parts of it. Like, that's at least what I did from the beginning. It's just play with all parts of this pipeline and just figure out what I really want to do, what I have fun doing. And for me, that was synthetic data. It doesn't mean I didn't spend time with evals and training and so on. And once you find that, make sure you're comfortable and familiar with other parts, but try to maybe advertise yourself as an expert in X on pre-training, not just, I work on LLMs. That's okay, but what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Right. What part of, how, if we work together, what are you actually going to contribute to the project is a lot more valuable to me.
And my last question is, you're right at the eye of the hurricane, so what can you tell us, where should we look at in the near future, like 2025?
Yeah, you know, it's unclear, I think, to anybody, especially that this just is changing so much. Like, what isn't going to happen in a couple of weeks? Unclear. but hopefully, we'll still, for the near future, stick. Like, I think how open source is going, and folks can't see us, but they can only hear us. But I think if what I'm doing right now in my hand is that I think open source will rise in popularity, and then plateau for a little bit, and then go down slowly and then plateau again. I think that's so we are still in the rise. We're still in the first part of this plot. And so in the near future, I think open source will just get more popular. I think SLMs will get more popular. Synthetic data will get more popular. And also post-training, it seems, to be taking the lead recently. So, which is a good thing. For a minute there, it was taking. It's just basically, I mean, we have a limited time and limited research resources. And so once people get to it, at some point it's going to be, for example, one that is doesn't get as much like multimodal and so on. Like, these things are just, they're a bit kind of, there's a priority list. And once we feel a little bit better about things higher on the priority list, we'll get to them. But hopefully things will just continue to be more principled and the resource will be accessible.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Mara, for your time and sharing your knowledge with us. If folks want to maybe continue this conversation directly with you or reach out to ask a question, something like this, where should I go?
Oh, sure thing. On Twitter is honestly like, tweet and tag me on Twitter. I don't mind. Feel free to like you share something or ask questions or honestly just go on our Hugging Face like under like our community tab in Hugging Face 405. If you have like a specific technical questions about Phi, we try to respond to people and just again, if you put something out there and you have to be a little bit responsible to it. So go for it.
Awesome. The links will be in the description. Thank you once again. Congratulations on your fantastic work with Phi4 and the whole team.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This was awesome.
Foi muito legal. A galera vai gostar bastante. E para você que se interessou em talvez querer trabalhar com a equipe da Microsoft, ajudar a desenvolver as próximas versões do Phi, ou sei lá, se você quer entrar, mergulhar no mundo da inteligência artificial, um dos passos que você pode dar, um dos primeiros passos, ou segundos, um dos passos é você acessar aí a conferencebrasil.com.br e garantir o seu lugar, o seu ingresso no lote atual de ingressos antes que passe para o próximo lote. Para você, junto comigo, com o Fabrício, com mais um monte de gente muito interessada em inteligência artificial, poder acompanhar as palestras de gente parruda no IA Conference Brasil. Rola em 13 de agosto no Centro de Convenções Rebouças, em São Paulo. Vai ser um dia repleto de palestras com direito à participação remota, mais palestra de Stephen Wolfram, amigo do podcast, já participou aqui também. Mas não só ele, Anderson Rocha, Alexandre Cavegato Filho, Luciano Martins, Caio Gomes, Micael Ohana, Hugo Abonizio, Vinícius Caridá, Sérgio Lopes e vem mais nomes por aí, inclusive. Então já garante o seu lugar, vai ser muito bacana encontrar e aprender junto de todo mundo o que esse pessoal parrudo tem a dizer, mas não perde tempo. Lembrando que tem desconto para grupos, duas pessoas, para a gente já é um grupo, vocês conseguem desconto. Conversa com a empresa, fala com o chefe para garantir o ingresso para vocês e vocês poderem acompanhar com a gente, aprender com a gente em 13 de agosto em São Paulo. Não perde essa chance e eu e o Fabrício estaremos de volta na sexta-feira com muita notícia sobre o nosso, do nosso resumão aqui das notícias que estão pintando nessa semana sobre o mundo da inteligência artificial. Até lá!
Este podcast foi produzido pela Alura, mergulhe em tecnologia, e Faculdade FIAP, Let's Rock the Future. Edição Rede Gigahertz de Podcasts.